The Live on a Form podcast is brought to you by Human 24. We are a human optimization community for everyday performers seeking to maximize their time spent on this planet. The Live on a Form podcast is a journey through conversation with people we have met along the way who have and still are inspiring us with their unique and unconventional journeys and restless pursuit to fulfill their human potential. Strivers, experts, creators, legacy builders, and everyday performers. We take a look into how their mind works, what fuels their pursuit of purpose, and how they use ingrained daily habits to ensure that structure defeats chaos as they chase their unique potential. We share insights with them as we unpack the lessons they have learned down the often broken road of personal growth, business building, accountability, and self-development as they share their stories and expertise with us. If you like this episode and enjoy what we're doing at Human 24 and on the Live on a Form podcast, please subscribe and leave a review to support us. Thanks, guys, and hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, Tommy Coyle, welcome to the Live on a Form podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Tommy, obviously well-known, well-known and famous for your career in boxing, ex-Commonwealth lightweight champ, had some amazing fights, especially in your hometown, the home city of Hull. And having been somebody myself who's kind of, you know, built a business and lived around Hull for probably a decade of my life, I just know the depth of feeling for people that people have for you in Hull. You're universally loved and appreciated there. So for me, it's really interesting to meet you. You know, I've sort of seen you around. We were mentioning before, I've seen you around a few times, but never really had the pleasure of being introduced. So, yeah, it'd be great to, kick off with what's life been like since retirement? 18 months ago, is that right?
Yeah, 18 months. It's been tough. Very, very tough. Adjusting, you know, on that transition from being an animal on the daily, you know, just being an animal mentally, physically, to being a civilian, you know.
Yep.
Not having a fire. I have a lot of energy, you know, a hell of a lot of energy. And having no fight anymore is tough. You know, you go to the gym and you train, you work out, but there's no real end product. So I've kind of had to design an end product. I've kind of had to find new purpose, find new meaning. And it's been a real, real journey for the last 18 months, but I've learned a hell of a lot about myself. I've also learned a hell of a lot of stuff about some of the people I used to have around me as well.
Okay.
You know, you retire, people start to go missing, and it's been eventful, but I've never shied away from adversity. And I kind of took the transition on as a challenge.
Okay.
And I said, right, come on then, throw it all at me. Let's see how tough this is going to be. And I genuinely think now I've kind of come out of it. But I'm not going to lie. I think I cried every single day for about 6 months. I actually lost a bet with Carl Frampton. I'd arranged to do a podcast live with Carl Frampton, the TKO podcast, to announce my retirement. And he said, I bet you're going to cry today. I said, nah. I said, I think I'm done crying, Carl. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll bet you 100 quid you cry. I says, well, I'll bet you 100 quid. I said, I ain't crying today. I said, I'm ready for it. I've geared myself up for it. Today's the day I'm going to announce I'm retiring. And anyways, I burst into tears. And I had to actually give him the 100 quid.
Oh, did you? Even worse, mate. It's interesting. I can remember, I think the first time I probably saw you probably outside a boxing ring was at PhD. We sponsored a charity. It was a charity kids boxing event in Driffield, the Driffield Showground. It was a black tie thing. I think it might've been about 2015 or maybe 2016.
Yeah, it was actually probably 2016 because it was just after the fight with Luke Campbell.
That's right, yeah. And I can remember you came, you did an after dinner speech, and it really stuck in my mind. You know, so two things really stuck in my mind. And I've listened to loads of bloody after dinner speakers, and they're polished and they go on forever, and it's a bit boring. And you spoke for about 5 minutes, and at the end, I turned to my wife. My wife was there. We had a table with PhD, and she had tears in her eyes. And I'm like, "What are you crying for?" And she said, "You know what?" She said that was beautiful. And you spoke about, really, because it was a kids' boxing event, you just spoke about what boxing meant to you when you were a kid, and how it gave you purpose and kept you disciplined and kind of give you a reason, you know, to, and an outlet for all that energy, right? I can remember thinking two things. One, you're going to struggle for a bit when you retire.
Yeah.
And then two, boxing's just the start for somebody like you, because you've got so much else to give and so much else to pass on, that I kind of always thought your bigger career would be after boxing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Listen, boxing for me doesn't save my life. Definitely 100%. I was a bit of a bad kid. I hung around with some, I won't say bad people. They just did bad things. But they were actually good people. They actually had good moral and good principle. Well, some of them did. But boxing saved me. Boxing was, it was my diversion. I had to be somewhere at 6:30 every night. Yep. And if I wasn't there at 6:30 every night, the competition was going to get in front and I was going to get behind. And I've always been a winner. I've always had a winner's mentality. I've never liked losing. And I didn't want to get behind. And I turned up, you know, every single night I turned up and I put in the work. Even went back the following day after I'd had beatings, you know, and not got the best of sparring, or I've always had the mindset, refuse to lose. You know, yep. If you can't find a way, fucking make a way.
Yep. Yep. And that work ethic, I guess, is that something, I don't know, is that something you're born with? Have you learned that? Have you been shown it? Because I know you're, you know, I know you're famous for, or you're certainly well known around the whole area for, you know, for working, is it your dad's yeah, market, stall that you work on? Yeah, your market stall.
I'm a market trader. I'm a trader. All right. Everything in my life's for sale except my three kids and my wife. Everything is for sale.
I love it.
The price is right. If it makes money, it makes sense.
Absolutely.
I've always been a trader. But I'm a big believer in talent only takes you so far. All right. Talent only gets you so far. But if you're willing to work hard, make sacrifices and persevere in times of adversity, then success eventually is inevitable. So I was a young kid and I knew I wasn't as good as all these other kids, but I knew they wouldn't be willing to work as hard as me. And I'd be willing to sacrifice it all. Okay, you know, a lot of them, there was underage nightclubs and stuff like that on a Wednesday night. Yeah, I went to them when I didn't have competition. But some of the great fighters in that amateur club, they still went to the nightclubs even when they had competition.
Yep.
I locked myself away. I was always extremely disciplined. And you know what? Every time I got beat or I got stopped or I got hurt, it wasn't the end. It was never, oh, you know, maybe I should contemplate giving this up. It was like, we go again. And yep. You know what? I think it's down to, Jason. I think it's down to my old man. And I always end up speaking about my old man. My dad, by the way, is my best mate. And you couldn't have him on this podcast because it would be extremely extra.
I know, mate. I know. I've heard.
A lot of people have heard. But my dad was like this year. And I get passionate about my old man because he gave me the best education I could ever have in life. And I'll tell you a quick story about never giving up and persevering and finding a way and making a way. I was twagging school one day, right? Because me and my pal, Josh Hodgson, who actually now has gone on to be a very successful rugby player, he plays for the Canberra Raiders over in Australia.
Yep.
We used to miss the bus on purpose because we'd figured that if we miss the bus, we go to Asda, we get a sausage sandwich and we walk to school, we're going to miss the first three lessons. But by walking to school, we've still shown willing. And, you know, it was just an accident. We missed the bus. But look, we've turned up. We walked here. Jeez. Anyways, one day, gone to Asda. Fucking dad's van's in the car park. Big fruit van. And I think, oh, shit, I'm being busted here. But I was intrigued because I did my dad get up at 4 a.m. that morning to go to work. Because he'd always say, Debbie, get me fucking shoes. I'm late, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't even get up that morning. So I'm thinking, why is my dad in Asda? I just come in. Anyways, I walks in, goes to the cafe. My dad's sitting there having scrambled eggs on toast. I says, what are you doing, dad? He went, what the fuck are you doing? I says, oh, I missed the bus. He went, oh, yeah, that old chestnut. I went, no, I said, honestly, sir, I just thought I'd get a quick sandwich and I'd get to school. He went, sit down there, you. He went, Josh, get to school. So I went, dad, why aren't you at work? He went, listen, he said, you caught me out. He says, I've done all the money in, son. He said, I ain't got nothing left. My dad, by the way, was a terrible gambler. He was a bad gambler. He was the type of man that had gambled on whether which raindrop on the window was going to reach the bottom of the right. window. You know yep. what I mean? And he'd done all the money in. Now, at the time, I played for Leeds United. So my dad, and so did my other brother, Louis, he was taking us to Leeds in the van every single night, just, you know, and it was costing 30 quid a time in the diesel tank.
Yep.
Maybe 25 back then, it was a bit cheaper. Uh-huh. And I remember saying to him, listen, Dad, I said, don't worry about taking me train tonight, because he was always whining about it. You bastards cost me 25 quid every time, you know, I've got to take you training. So I said, don't worry about taking, because he was always shouting, my dad. He used to scare us as kids, but I'm glad because it made me hard. It made me tough. I say that, he didn't bring us up. He bred us like dogs. You know, he bred us he just bred us. He just made us tough and hard and resilient. So I said, don't worry about taking me training tonight, Dad. He says, oh, you. He says, be at them school gates, 4 o'clock. I'll get you to training by hook or by crook. He went, now get to school. So I goes, picks me up, 4 o'clock, gets in the van, and I'm not saying anything. I'm not really talking. And we get to the petrol station. And this is funny, because the petrol station we pull into, I now work with that company, Sewell on the Go.
Yeah.
And he pulls in, gets out, walks around, opens the petrol nozzle, puts the nozzle in, the fuel thing in. Fills it, goes past 25 quid. Normally, my dad's a market trader. He just lives day to day. 25 yeah. quid, no more, just enough to get there and back. Yeah. Anyways, 30 quid, 40 quid, 50. He brims it. He fills the fucking van. He's never done that in my life. The diesel's pissing out of the tank because he's put that much in. Thinking, I thought he was skint. Anyways, comes back around the front of the van, gets in the van and drives off. I says, Dad, what are you doing? I said, you haven't even paid for it. He says, correct. He says, but I've got enough diesel in this tank to get you and your brother to training all week. I went, right? He went, listen, he says, I won't get a letter off the police for about another 7 to 10 working days to say that I've drove off without paying. He said, 7 to 10 days, son. He said, do you know how long that is in my world? He said, I'll be back at work. He said, and I'll have a few quid in my pocket and I'll go in and I'll pay for what I've taken. And I was like, wow, he says, there's always a way, son, he says, and if you can't find a way, make a way. And I know it was wrong what he did. It was criminal, it's theft. But he saw it as a market trader's credit card. It was just like, yeah. yours today and pay 10 days later.
Yeah.
And he just showed me never to give up, just to find a way, just, you know what, find a way, make a way. And oh, God, my upbringing on the markets with my dad would never let me wear gloves. You've started. He wouldn't let me wear gloves. He said, fannies wear gloves.
Not even your little fingerless ones.
No, right? Because honest to God, and I'll tell you why, right? Because it used to be metal store bars that we had to put together. I said, Dad, my hands are freezing. I was only 9 and 10, by the way, when I started working for
the hell, yeah.
And he went, listen, fannies wear gloves. Like, so I said, all right. I said, don't be a fanny, but my hands are cold. He said, listen, you just grab the bars and you grab them tight. He said, then you rub your hands together like this and you get them warm. He said, pain is an emotion. And I used to think, you're crackers, Dad. Like, you are nuts. There's nothing wrong with wearing gloves if you're cold. It's actually smart, you know, to put a pair of gloves on to keep your hands warm so you can perform better. But he was just building me. He was building me into a resilient young man that, and he taught me to do things that I didn't really want to do, but I did them like I love them. Like today, I was at the market this morning and I was setting the tomatoes up. And I didn't set out and think, right, I'm going to put the best flash on this morning. He just said, you concentrate on each tomato. You put each tomato or each apple and you lay it perfectly. And when you stand back after 3 hours of setting up, you've got a perfect display. And he just, my dad was the best backwards life coach I could have ever. I've just lost you there, Jason, but I got you back now.
It's okay, we're back, mate. Yeah, I was just talking about retrospectively looking back at your childhood. It probably seemed really tough and unfair back then. But you've got three boys yourself now. Are you, you know, do you take any of your father's advice there, or are you a completely different father?
I am different. I'm very different, but. If somebody went on my Instagram now and looked at my highlights, there is a highlight that says, boys at work with daddy. So my dad did things like this to me. He would send me to bed on a night and he would say, have a good day at school tomorrow, son. But then at 3 o'clock, he would come to my bedroom and he would say, I need you to get up. And I was only 8 and 9 years of age, by the way. My boys are 5, 4, and 1. And he would get me up at 3 in the morning and he'd say, he'd make out that he needed me. And when I look back now, like you say, retrospectively, it was all about building that resilience. And it made me go to bed thinking I was going to school, but then he'd get me up when I didn't want to get up. He'd throw me a curveball. And it was about just adapting to the situation. Shit, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I got to get up. I got to get a warm jacket on. I got to go out into the cold. And I've got to load a van at 3:30 a.m. So the other night, I said to the wife, she said, oh, leave him in bed. So I went, no. I said, I'm getting him up in the morning. Because my kids have got a privileged life. I've been fortunate that I've done reasonably well. And we have nice holidays. They have nice toys to play with. They have food in the cupboards. They don't have a pound slot TV machine, or they're not on the electric meter or the gas card like I was.
How do you find that, Tommy? Do you find that difficult, given how different it was from you? Because I'm the same. I've got a 6-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl, and you know we were a typical, you know, West Yorkshire working class family, and my dad was a warehouse labourer, and my mum just did odd jobs, really, just because she looked after us. Yeah. And my kids now are completely different. Does it irritate you?
It doesn't irritate me, but so I'm going to give all my fortune away, Jason. I want my kids, listen, there'll be a little bit of a safety net there, but I'm going to make it so they've got to go and make it for themselves. And learn from their own scars, because I think it makes them. If I have this thing like, you know, empty pocket makes you hungry for success.
Yep.
If your pockets are full and you've got no reason to get out of bed in the morning, you're never going to get out of bed. So I do want to make it tough for them. And as I was just saying, I've started making it tough for them already. So I went and woke them up at 4:30 a.m. last Saturday. It's on my Instagram highlights. And I said, right, I need you to get up. And they didn't want to get up. My youngest one, he was straight up, but they was tired. And it took them 3 or 4 minutes to actually get out of bed. But I made them go to work and smash all the cardboard boxes up. And I don't mind giving them a great life, but I want them to understand how privileged they are, how fortunate they are, and how tough out there it is. Like, we do a lot of things in the community, and every Christmas we do certain things, and I take them with me. And they're starting to get to the age now where they understand that they're very fortunate.
I talk a bit about that, you know, the things you do in the community, Tommy, because I've seen the things you've done in the past, and that's probably one of the reasons why you're kind of universally loved around the area. You're a real big name, and people love you there. What's the motivation for that, number one? And then two, you're obviously really passionate about your area and passionate about the city. Explain a bit of that to me, because I think, having been around Hull for 10 years, I find it a kind of a prevalent attitude. People are really proud to be from there.
Hull and proud, 100%. Listen, Jason, I wasn't the best fighter in the world. I wasn't even the best fighter in the city. But Hull supported me time and time and time again in victory and defeat. And they've given me some of the best memories of my life. And the city as a whole has made me feel very, very good a lot of times.
Yep.
And I know how tough it is out there for certain people and you know, in certain areas. And I'm just a big believer. Like, I've had a lot of people help me, Jason. I didn't get to where I am now on my own. I've had sponsors. I've had mentors. I've had tons and tons of help. And I've never forgotten that. I think it would be very rude and very arrogant of myself to say that I'm self-made. Nobody's self-made.
No, I agree. Yep.
Your mum and dad made you. Yep. You know, they made you. I've had so much help. And it's about sending the elevator back down. That's what it is. Someone sent the elevator back down for me, and now it's my turn. And I think if everybody just looked after their corner of the world would be a better place. And I guess maybe it's a little bit selfish of me, because it does make me feel good. You know, it's probably the most selfish thing you can do to help somebody else, because it makes you feel good. But you know what? I'm doing it. That's the main thing. And I just wish everybody was equal. I really do.
Yeah.
But I understand not everybody's equal, because not everybody's got the same mentality.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't need anything. I don't need anymore. I've got a pair of shoes on. I have food in my cupboards. My bills are paid. I've got a car. I live in an house. If there's any cream left at the end of the month, I'm going to share it out. Mm. Because I think abundance makes you weak.
Yeah.
I think abundance of, I don't know, money and availability, access, it makes you weak. Empty belly, you know, gives you a strong mind. You ever had fish and chips? How do you feel after fish and chips?
Mate, I love fish and chips. I'm going to get them tonight.
I know, but how do you feel when you've ate it? You feel shit. You want to just go to sleep.
I feel a bit shit, yeah. I feel the same after pizza. Fish and chips, pizza, I feel fat and lazy.
That's it. So, like, being empty is what I'm trying to get at. Being empty and having a little bit of scarcity, you kind of, I don't know.
Keeps you hungry.
It puts like lighter fluid on the fire.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, taught resilience as you were growing up. That's obviously, you know, kind of perfectly suited to a career as a boxer. So when did you start boxing? When did you first fall in love with it? And then I guess moving through your career, when are the most notable occasions that you really, really remember, you know, that you'll take to your grave with you and be really proud of?
My first ever fight, and this gets me real upset. My dad's not told me. I talk about my dad a lot. I'm sorry, but he's my hero.
Yeah? Absolutely, he's my best friend. I can see that. Like,
and I don't talk too much about my mum, but my mum, she was the glue what kept it all together. But because my dad was very hands on with me, you know, and after my first professional fight, he told me he loved me, and like, I was just boxing a guy that I was supposed to beat. You know, he was just a format. And he told me he loved me, and I'll never forget that. He was in Doncaster, Dome.
Wow.
But, You know, I was 6 years of age when I went in the gym. Do you know a guy called Carl Heath?
No, I don't.
Carl, he was a bad kid. I think he holds the record for stealing every charity donation box on Hesel Road. But he turned his life around. He was an orphan. And he turned his life around. And it's kind of like my life's mirror imaged. I've kind of, I don't want to undermine it, but maybe took it to the next level only because of the, you know, the platform that I created from the boxing. But he had a company called BoxWise, and it was all about saving kids. And he realized that I was probably going to be one of them kids what needed saving. Yeah. And it was Carl Heath who took me in the gym when I was 6 years of age. And he took me in the gym. He actually bought me, do you remember the VHS tapes?
I do, mate, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely remember
VHS
them.
VHS tapes. It was a Prince Nazim, Licensed to Thrill. And, I mean, what a fighter he was, by the way.
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah, a showman.
Oh, and, yeah, amazing.
I just fell in love with the game. And I went down to the gym. I got beat up the first night, but I was hooked. I straight away, 6 years of age, I remember the kid beating me, Billy. And I couldn't wait to get back in there, get better, and then ask him to come and spar me again and beat him. Like, I wanted to get him back. But I wasn't quite good enough yet, so I was going to get better, and I was going to get better, then I was going to bash him up. And, I did. I ended up bashing him up several times as an amateur over the years. But he put fuel on the fire, so I thank him. I thank Carl Heath. And, you know, the night I got knocked out by Derry Matthews in my hometown in front of 10,000 people, winning a fight, boxing probably the best I've ever boxed.
I remember, yeah.
And boom, he switched my lights off with one punch. But it taught me so much. You know, you've got to be disciplined in your game plan. You got to keep a cool head in a hot kitchen. So I've always learned from a loss. You know, the Luke Campbell fight, that devastated me. I actually spent time with Luke yesterday, and we was talking about this, and I said, we were talking about mental warfare, actually. I said, and I told him about some of the tactics that I used to try and, because I knew I wasn't as good as him talent-wise. Yeah. So I was using all kinds of stuff to try and get the upper hand on him. Anyway, it didn't work because he knocked me out as well. But I've got so many memories, you know. Boxing at Madison Square Garden. You know, I went from Queens Gardens Police Station to Madison Square Gardens. Queens Gardens to Madison Square Gardens. Like, what about that? I didn't reach the top of the mountain, but I reached the top of my mountain, and I'm extremely proud.
Yeah. And then towards the end of your career, it's interesting the way your mindset is, and I guess, you know, your upbringing. And I think the romance you see in boxing, and certainly what it can bring to young kids. Towards the end of your career, you went to Jamie Moore and Nigel Travis over in Moss Side. I've kind of followed those guys for quite some time, and I've always I loved Moore as a fighter. I can remember him fighting Macklin, and I kind of loved that fight. But I what those guys do, and in fact, I even read, I'm sure Nigel Travis said it, that boxing can save the world. I'm sure he said it. I read it on an interview.
100%. It is. I've not actually read that article, but when you just said it then, instantly, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It can.
And it was interesting. I just found it a really interesting kind of, you know, hook up that you with your mentality and your kind of, you know, the emotion you have around boxing for kids, how you moved towards, you know, those guys towards the end of your career. Was that, I mean, I get, it's obviously a conscious decision, but that must have been a good time in your career, and, you know, and probably, and I can remember the interviews, you know, when you're retired as well, and, you know, you got emotional around there. So that must have been a really great way to, or a great place to finish your fighting.
Jamie Moore and Nigel Travis are the best men I've ever met in boxing. I'm extremely grateful for them two men in my life. Like, they got the best out of me because they understood me. Like, there's an old saying, a happy fighter is a dangerous fighter. And they understood if I weren't happy, I didn't perform. Yeah. And they used to want me to stay in a hotel and be like this dowling monk and, you know, just completely live in Manchester and be away from my kids and my missus. But I just couldn't do it. So I used to sneak home at like 1 or 2 in the morning just to get in bed with my wife for an hour. And then I'd drive all the way back and I'd be knackered for training. And in the end, he kind of give up. He says, do what makes you happy. So I used to travel. I used to get a guy drive for me, drive me there and back. And he realized that, you know, you can't, well, I don't think he realized that. I think he knew that you couldn't train every fighter the same. And if I was happy, I'd perform. And we become best friends. Like, we had such a laugh. Like, if anybody ever followed our training camp, it was just like the playground. Pulling people's trousers down, burning people with a hot teaspoon, you know, blow horns in someone's ear, like, unexpectedly, you know, fire extinguishing people. We just had a laugh. We trained hard. And, you know, when I was in the ring, I wanted to take your head off. I want a nice person in the ring. I switched. But out of it, I just wanted to love everybody.
Yeah.
I just wanted to have fun.
It's interesting you mentioned you drove, at the start, you drove back, you know, to your family. What, do you find that, I mean, obviously family is really, really important to you, but do you find that, that it brings you peace and it brings you structure and the opposite to that is chaos, I guess. So, you know, family to you must be massively important because I can imagine, you know, someone, I guess, with your personality, if there was chaos in your personal life, you'd find it tough, right?
If there was chaos in my personal life, I'd find it extremely tough. But it's funny you say that. I actually get off on chaos in life. I actually find peace in the chaos. Do you know, like, say you, like, I can't just have a gathering at the house with the lads. I've got to get a singer down from London. It's got to be fireworks. Like,
right, okay.
And I can't just have a couple of people around. I've got to have everybody around.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, a pizza. It's like getting someone in to come and cook. I love hosting. And I just don't have a greedy bone in my body. I love giving it.
Yeah.
I love sharing it. But the thing with Holly is I knew she was pure. I knew she was real. She was with me when I didn't have a pot to piss in. She used to lend me a tenner out of a purse to get a taxi to the gym. Like, she had a car. She comes from quite a very successful family, and she had a car. I didn't have a car when I was young, but she had a car, and she would take me to the gym, drop me off. She's my best mate in the world, my missus.
Yep.
How she's put up with me, how she stayed with me, I'll never know. But I need a cuddle. I'm quite an insecure person, you know, and I probably don't come across on. I'm a very, very insecure person. I don't like being on my own. I had no staff this morning at the fruit store because we're spinning plates and we've got so much happening. And I woke my little brother up and I said, oh, come to work with me. He's only 15, but just don't like being on my own. I need people around me.
Yeah.
You know what as well, Jason? I think the reason why I had this little bit of an Indian summer in my career was because I'd always trained in the gym on my own with Jamie and Nigel. And then Cal Frampton turns up to the gym, Martin Murray, Rocky Fielden. And before we know it, we've got this stable of lads. And I was just like the class clown. I used to just think, okay, he's a great fighter. Him, like, and I'm burning them with teaspoons, fire extinguishing Carl Frampton on the first day to come to the gym. And because I was having fun and chaos, I started performing and I had a little rebirth.
But you've got that security. You know you've got that security and peace and contentment in your personal life.
Yeah.
Which allows you, and that allows you to express, you know, that kind of chaos and, you know, and fun side in your you know, the other life.
And then those people that I have close, I don't have any friends, you know. I have loads of people I know, but I don't really have many friends. I'm quite a lonely person. A lot of people that I thought was friends let me down. And I don't forgive easily.
No.
I can forget, but I don't forgive easily.
Yeah.
And Holly, my children, my three brothers, my dad and my mum, Jamie and Nigel, and my best mate, Jack. That's all I've got.
Yeah.
I got some good people that are very good friends, but I don't, you know, have much personal interaction. And they know who they are if they're watching this, but they probably won't like the names being mentioned. But I've got some very, very good people around me in business. And those people that have become very good friends and almost family.
I think that's often quite common, though, I guess, for people like you or aspirational, continually doing stuff, moving up, not looking backwards, and always, you know, looking to progress in your life. I think you know, unfortunately, you kind of leave some people behind, you take some people with you, and then you meet new people who bring really good things to your life, and you embrace them, and then again, you move on. And I think that's just normal. So 2019, you retired to Algeria. That was the last fight. I mean, you mentioned you found it tough.
Last fight, Chris. Yeah.
So tell us a bit about...
Horrible.
Tell us a bit about what it felt like when you knew that was it. And then, you know, a bit about that period after. And then we'll move on to what you're doing now, because I know you're doing a shitload now. So it'd be good to get to that.
I always wanted to get out of boxing with my faculties intact. Because for a kid who come away from school with no GCSEs or no real education, I've always been street smart. I've always been switched on. I knew how to market myself. I knew how to protect my brand. And I believe, you know, I've got a very, very successful health and well-being company. We work with a huge blue chip company, Siemens Gamesa. And how can I sell health and well-being if I haven't got my own health and well-being?
Yep.
And I knew the way that I fought put a lot of miles on the clock. And if you put your finger near the fire enough, you're going to get burned. And it was getting to a point where my eyesight was deteriorating and my health was not deteriorating, but it was becoming, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Without saying it, I was putting myself in the danger of you know, affecting my health.
Yep.
And I want to be able to read my kids a bedtime story. I do read my kids bedtime stories. The Highway Rat at the minute, actually.
Oh, mate, love that. Yeah, I've been through that.
Hey, you read that one?
Oh, I read that. Yeah, I love it.
The Gruffalo as well. He's very greedy.
Very greedy, mate.
Don't like greedy men. Anyways, digressing. And I really wanted to have one more fight. I wanted to sign off in Hull. I wanted to come back to my hometown and all those that couldn't go out to Madison Square Garden, sign a fight in front of them and have one more. But I was getting a lot of double vision. And I struggle with it now. I'm going to have an operation to correct my sight. And I just, you only get one set of eyes.
Yep.
And there's going to be a lot of things in my life what's going to change. And if I risk my eyes, I'm never going to see them.
Yep.
You know, my kids are going to get older. They're going to change. They're going to do things. I want to be there for my kids, a numero uno in my life. And there's much more to life than boxing. Boxing was just the first couple of chapters in my life.
Yep.
And I needed to... Well, Jamie Moore saved me, really. Jamie Moore saved me. He saved me from myself. And I wanted to get out of all my faculties intact so I could go on to do good things in business and be smart and stay sharp and look after my children and make the right decisions.
So how long did it take you to turn it around, you know, in your mind?
Yeah, it was long. So the fight was in July. And then I was like, September, Jay, I want a fight. I remember calling out Ryan Garcia. I'm glad he didn't fight me because he would have knocked my bollocks.
He's a monster, right? Yeah, the monster.
He said, do you know what? I went to Dubai and I remember sat on a boat with Jamie and we were looking at the, I've got the picture on me, so the picture's on my Instagram and we're looking at the Atlantis and we've got a bottle of Corona and we kind of toasted like this. And he just said, Tom, he says, you've achieved everything you're going to achieve. He says, like, all right, you didn't become a world champion. He says, but you boxed at the mecca of boxing, Madison Square Garden. He said, what better way to go out?
Yeah.
He said, you know, go out on top. I know you didn't win. He says, but go out on top. And I just knew, the moment I knew, I still actually, that's a lie because I kind of was like, yeah, Jay, you're right. You know, maybe it's time to call it a day. Then I come home. I had a couple of weeks in Hull, loads of people constantly asking me what's happening. I changed my mind again. Mm. And then I sparred a young man who comes in my gym and trains with us. And he's just turned pro at the minute and I'm training him. And I said to him, look, Donald, I said, would you spar me? I said, I just want to see if, you know, what my reactions like with my eyes. And he punched the granny out of me.
Yeah.
He absolutely knocked my bollocks in, just jabbing me. And I couldn't perceive distance or timing just because I had double vision. And I just thought, that's it. And I knew then and there and then. And I remember getting in my car and I just burst out crying. Yeah. And I knew it was over. But the first chapter in my book, what I'm just writing at the minute, is called Something in My Eye. And my book's going to be coming out early next year. And it's about the day that I rang Jamie Moore. I was in Fave and Harry's Cafe. So go in there. If someone wanted to kill me, they'd know where to find me. At 10 a.m. every morning when it's open.
There you go.
And, I rang him and I just burst out crying. He's like, wow, what's the matter? What's the matter? And I said, it's over, Jay. I said, I know it's over. I said, sparred last night. And he was right. Calm down, calm down. He come over to see me. And we decided that we was going to call it a day and announced it in January. And it was horrible. And it took me till the summer. The weather got a bit better. I started having people around. And then we got locked because we got locked down. So it was tough because I was overthinking everything.
Yep.
And I just thought, if I stay in the past, I'm going to stay in the past. You can't start a new chapter if you keep reading the old one. And I just thought, I'm only, 30 years of age? I've probably got another 50 years on this planet.
Yep.
I need to stop fucking dwelling and start grafting, you know, and start pushing and make it, finding a new purpose. And that's what I did. And now I'm, you know, I've been in the gym this morning with my personal trainer. I'm really, really content. I'm really, really happy. I'm pushing. I'm trying to build something. And yeah, I've got purpose.
That's an interesting point. Is and I was going to ask you, but I'll ask you now. What's more important, purpose or happiness? And which do you seek?
Purpose, because purpose gives me happiness.
Yeah.
I need something to chase. Listen, people talk about stress. If you're not stressed, you're not striving.
No.
Get used to fucking stress, being stressed.
Yep.
I don't want to be la-di-da-di-da, chilled out. I don't want to be chilled. I want to be stressed. You don't get diamonds without pressure.
No. Nope.
I want pressure. I want stress. I want a purpose. I want a reason to get out of fucking bed in the morning and go to war. Every day's war with me. I want to be the best. I don't just want to be the best in all. I want to be the UK's leading well-being and fitness brand.
Yep.
So, yeah, I get up and I can't wait to get up. I don't like going to sleep because I think it's a waste of time. But I know you've got to do, but because otherwise you're not productive the next day. But it's just boring, isn't it? You're just asleep.
So what's your day like now? Because I know I'm reliably informed you can still be seen outside Sewell's at 7:30 on a Saturday morning. So what's your day like now?
I got up this morning at 6. I was a bit late this morning because I was tired yesterday. I'd done some CrossFit training. 6 o'clock, I got up and I was like, and you know what? The wife, she drove me insane this morning. We had a bit, not a barney, we don't argue, but I raised my voice and she's, my wife's so chilled. She doesn't like me raising my voice. So I get up, she gets up with me at six. She comes down and says, we've got a painter in at the minute. And she says, oh, can you just move this table for me? I'm like, no. I said, I've got to be at work and I'm already late. She's like, oh, please. She says, if he moves on his own, he's going to scratch the floor. So me and her are moving these tables. I'm getting more and more stressed thinking, I'm late. So anyways, I did what I had to do, but I'm up, I'm showered, and I'm out. And I'm not coming back till 6 at night. Yep. 6 or 6, I'm out. Gets down the market, sorts the gear out. I gets to the wholesalers. I sets the pitch up. I goes to the gym. I trains. And then I obviously answered a few emails. And I went home because I knew I had this Zoom call with yourself today. And I wanted to put a shirt on. I wanted to put a jeans on. I wanted to polish my shoes. And I think we spoke about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We were live. And I got this little polisher. I got it for Christmas. It polishes them fine. It's mint. And I couldn't get to it because she's piled all this stuff in the like the cellar where my polisher is. So I says, I can't get to. She went, it's a Zoom call. Nobody's going to see your shoes. I said, it's not the point. I said, it's how I feel. I said, I need to feel good. I said, I want to look good and feel good. And I'm a bit intense. You've probably gathered this. I'm just an intense kid. I'm on a different frequency, I think, a lot of the time. And you probably understand that. I still wanted to polish my shoes, even though you can't see them.
No, I get it, mate. I totally get it. It's almost like it's almost like ingrained habits, isn't it? Do you like things neat and tidy?
Do you know what? I sound like a male chauvinist here, but I do like things tidy, but I don't do it because she does it for me. Right. But I think that's because she knows I like it tidy. She's an amazing woman. She, and if anyone's watching this, I believe women are far superior than men. Let me tell you, I couldn't do what they do. That is for sure.
Yeah, agreed, mate. Yeah. Right.
But she just looks after me, you know, and you can't sell a dream looking like a nightmare. If I had to come on your podcast today, I know you're credible. I know how well thought of you are in your field. If I had to turn up today with a cap on and a jogger suit and look the part, who's going to think I'm serious? I'm a serious guy. I need to look serious.
Yeah. So what's the future like for you, Tommy? You're not even a, you know, you say yourself, you're still a young guy. I mean, you know, boxing's behind you, but we'll never leave you. I saw you taking a youngish kid on the pads on your Instagram. You're doing a bit of coaching. Yeah. You've got your TC60. Just, I guess, tell us a bit about, you know, tell us a bit about your next quest, your next journey.
I wanna be the UK's health and wellbeing and fitness brand. I wanna be the best. I believe I've got an unbelievable concept in TC60. A lot of people think TC60 is Tommy Coyle 60 or Tommy Coyle 60 minutes workout. It's not. It's total conditioning. My time on the shelf is gone. I'm no longer a boxer. I'm probably not going to get too much more media coverage. And if somebody called John Smith wants to buy my franchise in Leeds, he's not going to buy something what's called Tommy Coyle. So it's total conditioning for everybody what's watching. And the plan is to take this brand nationwide because I think I've got the best training concept in the world. You got to believe it, right?
Absolutely.
I do. I think boxing, strength and fitness, you can totally condition the body in 4% of your day. And if you can't find 4% of your day, you've got too many time vampires in your life. So I think you can totally condition the mind and the body. You know, we introduced the session with a Pilates style warm-up stretching. The music's slower, and then the music gets a bit higher and the beat gets a bit louder. We introduce the boxing, the strength, the fitness, and it's sexy, it's cool. The lights and neon, the equipment, everyone's got their own equipment. They feel like they own it, they own the zone. It's an experience. Yep. It's like bringing New York Cool to Hull. Hull's never had it. I think we're the best. And I've also got this wellbeing company, and we're looking after, as I mentioned, that blue chip company, seems amazing. We have four pillars to the company. We have eat well, move well, sleep well, and think well. And I believe if you eat well, you're more inclined to move well.
It's
if
massive,
we move well, we know that you're going to go to bed and sleep well. And if you sleep well, 9 times out of 10, you get up and you think well. So it's that 360 wellbeing. And it's about, I've not got, if you ask me what my product was, I'd say I don't have one, because I don't have an off-the-shelf product to say, oh, bagel raisin, I can sell you A or B. I go into the wellbeing place, I identify the problems, and I provide the solutions.
Yeah.
Here's your problems, because every workplace is different.
Yeah.
You know, some people are working nights, some people are blue collars, some people are white collars. So I go and I identify the problems, and I use my profile, not my profile, but my personality, my character, to engage with people and speak their language. I can speak to the kid on the street corner, the CEO in the boardroom, the kid in the factory. You know, I've got that language for everyone. I'm a communicator. And I identify the problems. I come back to the boardroom with a team, and we provide the solutions to make them happier, healthier.
I think it helps. I mean, you definitely have, you know, every time I've sort of seen you interview, and even that time I saw you, you know, I mentioned at the start, you know, I saw you speak, you've got that thing that not many people have, and it's just that natural likability. And I think it's that passion. I think it is passion, but I think it's also that thing that people and businesses now spend a lot of time trying to get. And if you try and get it, it's pointless. Authenticity.
Right. Listen, this podcast will go on for hours if we start about this. I'm telling you now. Give me software over hardware any day of the week. I don't want somebody who can do a fucking spreadsheet or whatever. I want someone who's likable, who's got charisma, personality, looks the part, plays the part, preaches it, teaches it, is a professional. All that software stuff, it's hard to find. And we've got a set of key core values in the company, and we hire and fire on them.
Yep.
If you ain't going to adopt them and live them and breathe them and be them, then this company ain't for you. And let me tell you, you can all have a slice of the action on my firm, you know, on our firm. You can all get a slice of the action. I have that thing like, I'd rather have 50% of something than 100% of nothing.
Yeah, completely agree.
You all partners, but let's be professionals.
So you're in, again, on your social, I've seen you're in pretty good shape, mate. You're ripped to bits at the moment. What's your own training like?
I'm doing loads of functional stuff. I had this conversation with a pal of mine the other day. I don't want to be like one of them kids who's finished, got in shape, real big, walks like I've got carpets under my arms. I want to be functional.
Yeah.
And if somebody says, what's under the bonnet? I want to be able to say, fucking plenty of gas.
Yeah.
So like, I don't want to just look great and be a trophy. I want there to still be a bit of substance. So like, I don't know. I've got young kids. Like it might still go off in my life. I might be in a car park or a play area, and someone's dad gives my kid a little bit of shit. It might have to go off. Yeah. I still want to be able to do it.
It's funny that, and then you do start think. I mean, you're quite a bit younger than me. I'm 45, and you do start to think about your mortality.
You look good for 45. I hope I look like that.
Thank you, mate. Yeah, well, I've not got punched in the head as much as you, so. Yeah, you do start to think about your mortality, and you start to think about what, you know, my training now is, you know, I want to live really well for a long time. I don't want to live any longer. I don't want to live to 120. That'd be a fucking nightmare. But I'd like to be really fit and vibrant as long as I possibly can. And, you know, my boy's 6, you know, we didn't have children until I was 38. So you're just busy with business. And that sounds bad, but literally, I didn't come up for air until I was about 36. And I thought, shit, I better start thinking about a family. But really kind of thinking about, you know, that I want to be in a situation when, you know, when my little boy's 14, 15, they might need me. I'm going to be, I'm going to be in my 50s. You know, I want to be vibrant and strong and be able to do something about it. You know.
Yeah, I'm training fighters at the minute, and I'm asking their conditions, what scores they're getting on the ski ergs and the watt bike, because I want to make sure I'm keeping up with them.
Yeah.
Like, how can I expect them to do it if I can't do it? I never want to be one of them coaches. I want to be able to say, right, do this, and they're like, I can't. Well, if I can do it, you can do it, or you should be doing it. I'm not just, because I had that great experience with Jamie Moore. Jamie was more like a life coach.
Yep.
I wanna be a life coach to my kids as well as a dad, and I want to be a life coach to the fighters that I'm helping, as well as a coach.
I was going to say that. Would you ever bring through a fighter and be a real kind of mentor? And would you, you know, if they got to the point where they were good, would you take a fight under your wing and take them all the way and, you know, dedicate yourself to that?
Yeah, definitely. I just don't want to get involved with many fighters financially.
Yep.
Like, okay. I want boxing to remain my hobby, my passion. Okay. I don't want to take 10% off anybody, you know. There's a man in boxing called Kerry Kays.
Yep.
And I tried giving him some money once for expenses. And he went, Tom, you're going to spoil what I've been doing for 20 years in boxing. I said, what's that? And he was in Ricky Hatton's corner, Tony Bellew. Everybody says, that's, you know, taking money off a fighter. He said, I just don't do it. He said, it's my hobby. And you know him, I think.
Kerry from Sports Nutrition. Yeah, yeah. He was the original founder of CMP.
Kerry's a beautiful man.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I love this guy. I just thought PhD.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
CMP. And, wow. And I want to make my business so successful that I don't need boxing financially. Listen, there's nothing wrong with taking 10% on someone. Trainers deserve it. Managers deserve it if they do the right job like the ones I have. But for me, if I don't need to take it, I'm not going to take it. And that's why I'm working so hard on my business. So boxing for me can just be the hobby and I can love it and live it and breathe it. I've seen so many fighters, Carl Frampton, where people have just abused him.
Mm.
And he's put his life on the line every time he stepped in the ring.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to pick the fighter up because he don't drive just yet and take him to the gym and, you know, square him a few quid. And I love a lost cause. I love a lost cause.
Yeah, I get that. I get that from you. Yeah, I get that.
I love helping someone. I do.
Yep.
My dad goes mad about the homeless because they're tarnishing his business. But I love him. All the business sleep where his fruit stall is.
Oh, right, okay.
Like, you know, no, the old ladies won't come into the town anymore because they're scared. But then when I go to the store, I'm giving them all money and food and drinks. And he's like, they're never going to fucking leave if you keep giving them food and money. But, yeah, it's funny.
Let's finish on your book then, Tommy. You mentioned your book earlier. What's that going to be about? Is it going to be a life story? Is it going to be taken from a certain time in your life onwards?
It's going to be a bit of everything. It's going to go right back. Talk about some of the run-ins that I had with my dad, which there's so many of them. Guns, police, hickory bats. Loads of things. It's going to just be a journey right through my life. And I don't know, maybe there'll be a second edition. I'm not experienced enough to write a book on business yet, but I'm constantly learning and constantly studying. So I once read this thing of what Will Smith said, and he said, the keys to life, he said, are running and reading. And he said, why running? He said, because when you're on a treadmill and you're running, there's a little voice inside your head, which says stop, or I can't go any faster, or I can't go any further for any longer. He said, if you can learn to defeat that voice, you can learn, you can do anything in life. He said, but why reading? And this was the bit what got me. He says, there is no new problem in life. And this ties in with your podcast, Jason. There is no new problem in life. He said, there's been millions and millions of years go by. He said, there isn't a problem what somebody hasn't written about,
yep,
and you can go to the library and read about.
Yep.
So I started thinking about this and I thought, I'm going to go to the book read about this problem that I've got and learn how they overcome it. And I guess it's a little bit like your podcast. There might be people watching this and they might take a bit of inspiration from it or learn how to, you know, just persevere or push on. So that's what you're doing. You're offering the new version of reading.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I started to do a lot of reading from, again, when I came up for air about 35, 36 year old. And I'd kind of a bit of an intellectual rebirth almost where I thought, shit, you know, I just found loads of things interesting and I had more time to learn. And I, it's that old kind of saying, you know, if you can accept that you know nothing, then, you know, and you can step away from the ego, you know, get rid of the ego, accept that you know nothing, then you can learn then. And we've got so much to learn, you know, more than half your life left, which is exciting.
I just started listening to Ego is the Enemy.
Oh, Ryan Holiday.
Yeah. So,
yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of his.
I'm constantly trying to upskill myself. You know, I'm not the finished article. I don't know everything, as we just said. We've got two ears and one mouth. If we listen twice as much as we speak, we'll be twice as smart.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm all ears, and I've enjoyed this. Listen, we need to meet up properly.
We'll do, mate. Once we can escape house arrest, and I can come out. It'd be great. As I say, I've always, you know, followed your career and known a lot of people who, you know, sort of know each other. You know, some mutual friends. But I've always had a massive amount of respect for you, mate. So it's been great to catch up.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I've known of you for years and what you did at PhD, and what a brand that is, by the way.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you on a more personal level about brand and protecting that brand.
Anytime, yeah. No, you're welcome, mate.
Give me brand over profit any day, because brand makes profit.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's eternal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your time, mate.
Cheers, Tom, mate. I appreciate it, mate. Take care. Bye-bye.